notwithstanding the seriousness of the budget deficit that we face, we go into this situation on much stronger fiscal footing than we went into the Great Recession. California at that time had essentially no budget reserves, and its cash liquidity was very weak.
Well, welcome back to the Public Money Pod, a production of the Center for Municipal Finance at the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy. And we are proudly sponsored by Build America Mutual, MuniPro, Odyssey Advisors, and the Government Finance Officers Association. I'm Justin Marlowe, joined as always by my intrepid co-host, purveyor of long story short, bona fide fiscal policy expert, Californian chicken connoisseur, Liz Farmer. Liz, welcome back.
Thanks, Justin. Thanks. I want to say a week or so ago, I had the pleasure of talking about journalism and newspaper writing to my son's fifth grade class because they just started a class paper. And it was so fun. I guess like the kids asked really good questions. And of course, because you can't get away from AI. A couple of them asked about AI. So, I mean, it is everywhere. But shout out to Mrs. Lord's fifth grade class at Boonesboro Elementary School. Bright group of kids, if I do say so myself.
That's great. That's great. And I bet your mom cool factor shot up a few points after
that. I hope so. Honestly, that's what I was worried about the most. So we'll see. My son assured me that it was very cool. So
that's right. I suppose, like, in hindsight, I could see how that could go in the other direction if it hadn't gone well. Wonderful. Well, that's great to hear. Well, speaking of cool stuff and interesting topics and AI, I suppose, too, we're here to talk today about California. And we'll do some California dreaming, as they say, with Gabe Pettick, who is the legislative analyst for the state of California. You know, we talk all the time about California on this podcast, Liz, for lots of different reasons. They've been in the news at the state level in particular as of late because they're facing, you know, yet another massive budget deficit, somewhere in the $73 billion range or thereabouts, depending on whose numbers you trust. And that's on a roughly $210 billion budget. So just to put things in kind of California terms, that's it's a lot of money either way, but in percentage basis, a large budget deficit by any measure for any standing state facing a budget deficit in the neighborhood of, you know, 30% or thereabouts, it would be noteworthy. So we want to talk to Gabe about that, to talk about sort of how they got there, where they're going, and talk a little bit more broadly about the role of the legislative analyst and how he in particular got there. Those of us who have been around Muniland for a while know that that's an interesting story. He came from the ratings agencies, and it's always kind of interesting to see one of our own, so to speak, go into that kind of a really high profile important role in state government, and how those past experiences in Muniland have really shaped his perspective on that role. So we're thrilled to have an opportunity to talk to him. You've grew up in California, know California public finance well. Those of us, I think anybody who's been around state and local public finance pays careful attention to what goes on in California, because for better or for worse, we often see the kinds of things that happen in California make their way throughout the rest of the country in the not too distant future. When you think about California as the leading edge of state and local public finance, Liz, what comes to mind?
Yeah, certainly. I think California is so exposed. I mean, it's like a live nerve when it comes to the economy sometimes. It's whatever is going to go on across the nation seems to happen there first, and it happens really dramatically so. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing right now with this budget deficit. I mean, California's is really large, but now other states are starting to see budget deficits as well for varying reasons. But I think one of the things that has stood out to me about California is, as back during the recession, it was an embarrassment because it was in such dire straits that the state had to issue IOUs. I mean, they didn't really have any reserves. I mean, budget sustainability and fiscal responsibility was not something that was at the forefront. And then Jerry Brown made it his thing and kind of did this whole Governor Moonbeam about face, you know. And so I've always found that kind of piece of California's turnaround really, really interesting. And then came about the state proposition where they protected the state's budget a little bit from that revenue volatility by mandating that some excess revenue in those boom years go into the budget reserve and go on into paying off debt. And so over the last decade, the state has really gone from the one that people made fun of for issuing IOUs during the recession to one that is much more fiscally sound and stable than it was before. And I found that pretty impressive because you are dealing with a lot of money in California any way you slice it. There's a lot of people who live there. It's a really big state. And so that's been something that I've always kind of, you know, wanted to put in context when I think about California.
Yeah, I've seen so many other places then try to look at that turnaround and adopt elements of it that might work in their state, whether it's the same kinds of mechanisms to create and maintain reserves, changing the state-local relationship to try to make that a little bit healthier, lots of emphasis on things like economic mobility and housing affordability and all these other underlying drivers of those of that budget behavior. Really interesting stuff, and we're absolutely seeing, I think, lots of places look to the California example. They may not want to admit that, they may not talk about it openly, but it's absolutely a very influential part of what we see in state and local public finance writ large today. Well, we're pleased to welcome to the Public Money Pod Gabe Pettick, who is the legislative analyst for the great state of California. Gabe, thanks for taking the time to join us.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me to join you.
Yeah, we're really excited to dive into all things California. Me especially, since I get to talk about my homeland state, as I like to call it. First, though, legislative analyst, describe exactly, you know, what is that in California, and how does the LAO fit into the overall state government? Do other places have something similar?
So we are the state legislature's nonpartisan fiscal and policy advisor. If you go back to the 1930s, the legislature at the time had identified a need for its own analytical fiscal unit to serve really as a corollary to the governor's Department of Finance. And it took them a couple of attempts, but in 1941, the legislature passed a statute creating the office, which then Governor Colbert Olson promptly vetoed, and thinking that that's okay, we'll just stick with using my Department of Finance estimates for the budget work. But the legislature was undeterred and proceeded to create the office anyway through a special rule and funded the office out of a transfer from its own operating budget. The relevance of this history is that to this day, our office receives its funding from this transfer, which has the benefit of insulating us from the governor's veto authority. And ultimately, it has the effect of underscoring our independence, freeing us on behalf of the legislature to call it like we see it, vis-a-vis the administration's proposals. And so while we were the first office of this kind in the country, now all 50 states have some version of a fiscal office like ours. And as we understand it, the when the Congress established the Congressional Budget Office in 1974, they looked at the LAO as something of a template. So I think our history is actually kind of interesting.
So we've heard a lot about California's budget deficit for fiscal 24-25. Sounds like it's larger than usual, perhaps. Maybe not the largest ever, but larger than usual. I wonder if you could just kind of walk us through the landscape for that deficit. Sounds like the governor has some maybe different numbers from you all. I'm just kind of wondering what might explain some of those differences.
Yeah, it's a question we've received a lot. So back in December, our office released our annual fiscal outlook in which we estimated a deficit for the upcoming budget year 2024-25 of $68 billion. Several weeks later, when the governor put forward his budget proposal in January, he identified the deficit as $38 billion. And as I say, even for California, a $30 billion difference in the deficit estimate is notable. I would say that this difference sounds much larger than it really is. And that's because the governor's estimate reflects some adjustments to the state spending base that lower expenditures by about $20 billion, shrinking his deficit estimate by that amount. The largest of these was a change in the level of funding for education. So your listeners may or may not be aware, but in California, we have a constitutional-based funding formula for education. But the budget reduction that the governor assumes in this area would require a vote of the legislature in order to take effect. And because the legislature would have to act on this in order to recognize the lower level of spending in the budget, we view that as a proposed solution. And as I say, you know, you usually only propose a solution to a problem. And so when you add the $20 billion of these kind of assumptions back to his deficit estimate, you get to $58 billion. And so $58 billion is much closer to our $68 billion estimate of the deficit. But the remaining difference there really has to do with our office's different revenue estimates. And so the governor's proposal assumes that state tax revenues are in the midst of a rebound this year, whereas our forecast sees revenues remaining a little more stagnant this fiscal year and beginning to recover next year. And I will say that so far, monthly collections align more with our estimates and, for what it's worth, the historical trends or norms. Typically, after you experience a big revenue downturn in California, and last year the decline was about a 20% revenue drop from the prior year, it usually takes a year or two before they begin to recover. Now, January is a very significant collection month for us here in California. And in that month, we saw very weak collections. And then with the benefit of some updated economic variables, we put them into our revenue estimating model. And instead of a $58 billion budget deficit under the governor's proposal, we would say now that his budget reflects a $73 billion budget problem. And so I know there's kind of a lot of numbers there, but the bottom line is we think the difference really isn't that great. And at this point, we would now estimate that the state is facing a $73 billion budget problem.
So that's a sizable number, undoubtedly. How much, you've kind of alluded to this a little bit, but how much of that is what we might call a cyclical or kind of periodic deficit versus a, you know, more of a structural baked in kind of long-term revenue expense mismatch?
Yeah. So I think a little background is helpful here. In recent years, when the state had some extraordinarily large budget surpluses, the legislature and the governor allocated very substantial sums to temporary spending. So, for example, the current deficit estimate includes about $9 billion of one-time spending. And as that winds down, the annual deficits will shrink. But nevertheless, both our office and the Department of Finance in our multi-year estimate show operating deficits somewhere in the range of $30 billion per year. And we think this approximates the structural deficit right now. Part of your question, I think, is that the deficits are larger than they might have been otherwise, partly as a result of the earlier surpluses having been overstated, which relates to the difficulty of forecasting California tax revenues. In May of 2022, the administration's revised budget proposal reflected its expectation of an enormous surplus, somewhere in the range of $86 billion. And with the estimate of this surplus in hand, the policymakers went about allocating the surplus. Now, our office had cautioned that the revenue picture was turning. Our revenue forecast anticipated that the state would see a revenue downturn of about $8 billion in fiscal year 2022-23. Unfortunately, though, we were not able to confirm the severity of the revenue downturn in that year until much later than we normally would, because the IRS had delayed the 2022 tax filing date for most of California in response to some wintertime floods. And ultimately, the tax filing date was moved to November of 2023. So it was only at that point that we clearly saw that revenues in that 2022-23 fiscal year had dropped by $26 billion. So a much sharper drop than the $8 billion we thought was likely. So we got the inflection point right. We just were off on the magnitude. And from a fiscal standpoint, of course, the problem is that the policymakers had set the budget for both 2022-23 and 2023-24 according to overstated revenue assumptions. Whereas if we had known about the revenue downturn in April of last year, like we would normally, we would have begun addressing the deficit last spring. But instead, it kind of was allowed to fester throughout most of the year.
Didn't the state have to close or lawmakers have to close a 30-something billion budget gap to close fiscal 2023? Is that right?
Fiscal year 2023-24, the current year, the administration's proposal did in January acknowledge that the revenue picture had weakened. So that was the year after the 2022-23 year. So last budget cycle, we did begin to see some revenue erosion. Ultimately, the revenue erosion turned out to be a lot worse than we initially anticipated. So it does look like when we look back at the data in late 2022 and early 2023, that, you know, it almost looks like the state of California experienced a recession for a couple of quarters. I know they don't declare a recession at the state level, but we saw growing unemployed workers. We've seen the unemployment rate go from 3.8% in the fall of 2022. It's now over 5%. And there are 200,000 more unemployed workers in the state. And then just sort of the drop off in the investment activity in Silicon Valley and the tech sector. I think maybe that had a lot of ripples throughout California's economy and sort of underscored the importance of that sector for not just the state's tax revenues, but also our just broader economy. We had pretty weak sales and use tax revenues during that period too. So consumption overall in California was a lot weaker at that time than I think a lot of people may have realized when we were in the moment. Because some of this data, of course, really doesn't become available until well after the fact.
And as I recall, that California during the Great Recession, I mean, it took a 20% revenue hit that first year as well, or somewhere along those lines. I mean, to kind of put that in that's really big. I mean, most states aren't talking Great Recession right now, and neither is California. But I think it seems pretty significant. How much of that are you able to assess is due to the fact that revenue previously was like a one-time deal versus recurring?
I think you're touching on an important point. I mean, a component of the problem right now is that in 2020-21 and 2021-22, we had really exceptionally strong revenue growth of 30% and 20% respectively in those 2 years. So a very substantial part of the revenue downturn that we're having right now really is, maybe you'd think of it as a reversion to mean, or, you know, sort of a normalization. And then it's kind of continued to go down a bit further. But when you just look at the actual deficit numbers, they are quite large. And in nominal terms, rival what we saw at the time of the Great Recession. So, you know, it's not an insignificant problem that we face right now at all.
Certainly, when you talk about the challenge in forecasting those revenues, including and especially capital gains, we hear all the time about how for California, it's both a blessing and a curse that you have Google, Apple. Where so much of the growth in the stock market generally, right, the Fantastic Five or the Fabulous Five, whatever they're often called now, are such a huge part of what happens in the stock market now, and in turn driving investment returns across the country, but including and especially in California. Has it always been that way, given that Silicon Valley's been there and given that California's always had this kind of cyclical component, or has that part of revenue forecasting, especially for capital gains, become more difficult, just as it seems like that part of the tech economy has become so much more influential in thinking about where investors are putting money writ large?
Yeah, I think it's a complicated question, but we have tried to learn along the way here. And one of the things that we've come to realize is that the capital gains component is certainly a big part of the both the cursing and the blessing that you refer to, and the volatility essentially, but it also shows up in the withholding the wage withholding component of our personal income tax, because some of these highly compensated employees of tech firms and all the related services that they consume, from legal services and other consulting and banking type of activities, compensate their employees in the form of restricted stock units and bonuses. And a lot of that compensation appears in our wage withholding collections. And so the capital gains are always difficult to forecast, but we're finding that what had historically or traditionally that we thought of as the more stable component of the withholding portion has also exhibited more of this type of cyclicality that's very difficult to forecast. It's only gotten more complicated, I think, in California to predict our revenue experience. Some people have asked us, what is the problem? I mean, the stock market is at record levels. It seems like California should be doing well. And, you know, we've looked into that question too. And what we've, when we look back over history, what we see is that we don't need just that the stock market reaches at record levels. We kind of need it to be sustained there for a little while. So there's a lag in the period between when the market reaches new highs and when we begin to experience the benefit in terms of revenue collection. And also, to your kind of to your point, I think we really need to see that kind of appreciation in the markets accompanied by robust investment in our tech sector. And instead, what we saw is a big drop off in venture capital that has remained pretty anemic here in California, and also a very sharp slowdown in the level of initial public offerings that we saw coming out of Silicon Valley. So we had an 80% drop off from 2022 to 2023 in IPOs. And that's a really important source of revenue for the state.
I remember Prop, oh gosh, is it Prop 2? Back in the early 2010s, California has looked at, has you know, made this legislative and constitutional amendment change to manage that revenue volatility by capping off a certain percent. You know, when revenue increases X amount, all the extra goes to the budget reserve fund to paying off debt. Has the last few years just been so weird that even something like that can't kind of cushion California from what's going on? Or do is that something like that, you know, need to be supplemented with other measures?
That's a really good point. I'm glad you raise it. One thing I should say in all of this discussion is that, notwithstanding the seriousness of the budget deficit that we face, we go into this situation on much stronger fiscal footing than we went into the Great Recession. California at that time had essentially no budget reserves, and its cash liquidity was very weak, you'd say. And so Prop 2 has been a game changer. I would just say that, you know, in the face of a $70 billion deficit and $30 billion deficits annually thereafter, it's really not possible to, you know, build up a sufficient budget reserve to offset all of that type of gap. And so it does provide a good cushion that should allow the state to establish a smoother glide path back to structural alignment. But, you know, it's only a part of the solution. And for what it's worth, you know, the governor's budget proposal does recommend using around half of that budget reserve that we have. We have $24 billion in discretionary budget reserves. And our office has said we think that, you know, that's what the reserve is there for. And it would require the governor to declare a fiscal emergency, but we think that's pretty reasonable to consider doing. And it would leave the state with about $11 billion in its reserve after this upcoming fiscal year, which could be, you know, important given that our estimates are for continued fiscal stress.
Well, we've talked a lot about the problem and the nature of the deficit. What's happening on the solution side? And how is the governor proposing to close that gap? What sorts of options have you all identified? Tell us a bit more about where things are going to go from here.
Yeah, so in addition to the complicated proposal that I mentioned that the governor has around education funding, of the total budget problem out there, about 45% of the solutions that the governor is putting forward are spending related solutions. As I just mentioned, he proposes about $13 billion in reserve withdrawals to help close the gap, and then some smaller cost shifts and a pretty small component of revenue side solutions, only $400 million from increased revenues. In addition to our view that the use of the reserve, as he proposes, is roughly appropriate, we do have some thoughts about the governor's proposed spending side solutions. Specifically, he's proposing about $26 billion of spending side changes. And of that, around $8 billion are in the form of delays. Those have the effect of lowering spending in the budget year, but by pushing out the spending into subsequent years, they exacerbate the problems in those years. So our initial guidance to the legislature is that they may need to recognize some of those proposals as outright reductions. It's just the reality of the situation. And so they might have to recognize those as such. And then in addition to that, you know, I have mentioned that in recent years, the state has had these very large estimated surpluses. And with a substantial share of those being allocated, maybe as much as 93% toward one-time and temporary spending, we think that's an area where the legislature could find some part of the solution. It was prudent to allocate a lot of those seemingly unsustainably large surpluses to temporary spending. But then when you're faced with such a large deficit, our office has recommended that the legislature first look at pulling back on some of that one-time and temporary spending and helping use that to close the gap. And we've estimated that, you know, there's probably as much as $16 billion in deficit reduction available to the legislature and the governor beyond what the governor has proposed, spread out over the next three fiscal years. But even with doing all of that, given the multi-year nature of the deficits that we face, there's almost certainly going to be some amount of ongoing spending adjustments that will also be necessary. But we haven't really gone into a lot of detail on that part of the discussion just yet.
I could talk about budget deficits all day, but, you know, California has a lot of other unique things going on. So if we could maybe shift a little bit to housing affordability, which is a bit of a thing. It's a challenge everywhere. Right. But certainly California in particular, how does that affect or lack thereof of housing affordability? How does that affect the state's fiscal condition and the housing market? And, you know, most commonly we tend to think of that, you know, housing affordability and property taxes, local issue, but certainly the state is involved in that. So can you tell us, kind of explain that a little bit from the state perspective?
Yeah, definitely. You touch on it. I mean, the state's direct engagement in housing, and I would also say homelessness-related efforts, has increased substantially in recent years. As I think about this, there are two main reasons. First, the Newsom administration has been very explicit about acknowledging the housing and homelessness problem as an acute crisis in the state in a way that really hadn't been done by previous administrations. But then secondly, for several years of the governor's two terms, as we've been talking about here, the state did have these extremely large surpluses to work with. Specifically, across the four fiscal years leading up to 2022-23, the projections summed to about $202 billion in cumulative surpluses. Now, as I said before, not all of those materialized, but as they were developing those budgets in those years, if you look back at the budget development periods, that's the total surplus that they had allocated. And so recognizing that it wasn't likely to persist, you know, as I mentioned, the legislature allocated a lot of this to one-time and temporary type of purposes. And of that total, around $20 billion of these resources were allocated to housing and homelessness efforts, such as infrastructure grants to local governments to build out the infrastructure that would be needed for new housing developments. Fundamentally, I think all of these efforts are aimed at increasing the housing supply in California, which is needed in order to make the, you know, just to make housing more affordable to people in California. But now, as this temporary spending is winding down, I think the main way that the state can continue to address affordability is by trying to ensure that private builders don't face excessive impediments, and by incentivizing local governments to approve more housing. And, you know, that's the type of efforts that we see the state and the legislature contemplating at this time. I mean, ultimately, I don't think the full results of these, all of these efforts will be known for many years. And it took a lot of years for the state to get into this type of, this severe of a housing shortage problem. So it's probably going to take a long time to get out of it. But that's really the main way that I've seen the state's housing problem interact with our fiscal, is that the state is really just allocated so much more of its resources to this issue in a way that it really never had before. As you said, it was really traditionally thought of more as a local policy issue.
Kind of related to that, Gabe, your office has done something that I think is a little unique when you look at the work of legislative fiscal staff around the country. And you've talked a lot about economic mobility. I wonder if you could, number one, define economic mobility the way that, that your office looks at it. But then, you know, that's not something necessarily that we would think of as a direct kind of fiscal issue. What is the connection between economic mobility and the way that you all think of it as impacting the state's finances? You know, and then related to that, is there anything in particular that you all are looking at or recommending or analyzing as state level solutions to try to promote economic mobility?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And the way we think about it as policy advisors to the legislature is that we think the notion that someone's hard work, innovation, and talent will be rewarded with improved economic status is really fundamental to the functioning of our market-based economy that we have. And when we look at the data in California, we find that some groups, such as Black and Native American men, for example, appear to face greater barriers to mobility than other groups. And we see this type of disparity as problematic, not least because it can keep people in poverty and give rise to inequality. I don't think we fully understand the causes of economic mobility or its absence. On the one side, the research we've reviewed suggests that access to quality education, two-parent households, and social connections across economic classes are associated with higher mobility. Whereas on the other side, growing up in poverty, racial segregation, and involvement in with the criminal justice system seem to be correlated with lower mobility. And so it seems to me that the more of the latter that there is, the more pressure it can put on the state's social service network and therefore the budget. When it comes to the state's role, I do think that, you know, it's important that we recognize the limits of state government. Certainly, I do believe that the state can help in some ways, but I am pretty skeptical that if we just adopted the right policies, we could completely eradicate the problem of limited economic mobility faced by some groups. That said, I mean, programs that help children not grow up in deep poverty would seem to push against our state being stuck in a lower mobility situation, and perhaps even the housing policies that encourage home building in communities with low crime and high-performing schools would help as well. It's difficult to be too specific because I do think some humility is warranted here, given how, you know, we were saying we don't fully understand this problem. But, you know, it is a little different maybe for an office like ours to look into these types of issues. But the more that I talk to our legislators, our bosses in the legislature, I find that they care a lot about not just the efficiency and effectiveness of state government. They also care about some of these distributional questions. And even if our office isn't making recommendations for how they should address them, we at least want to highlight the kind of factual assessment of these problems. So, you know, I acknowledge that it's a little atypical perhaps, but we think it's really important.
Gabe, you know, a lot of our listeners are coming from the world of are coming from Muniland and municipal credit in particular. That's your background. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about, you know, your life prior to coming to the LAO and how that experience in municipal credit in particular has shaped your view on the job.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I have thought about this over the years. There are two ways in particular that come to mind for me. First is that the work at the rating agency had to be done in a nonpartisan way, which is really a core value here at the LAO. Secondly, I think the elements of sound credit quality are very aligned with those of prudent fiscal policy. And whereas at the rating agency, we talked a lot about structural budget balance as being important for the state to be able to be sure to fund its debt service, at the LAO, we focus on sustainability of state government, not just for debt service, but, you know, maybe more holistically. And I think one thing I may bring to the role is a bit of a comparative perspective. At the rating agency, we really sought consistency and scored the different states according to various economic, fiscal, and debt metrics across all 50 states, really. And so nowadays, I sometimes find myself asking our analysts how other states approach certain policies. And I suspect this instinct really is carried over from the credit work I did previously.
Well, thanks so much, Gabe Pettick, who is the legislative analyst for the great state of California. Gabe, thanks for taking the time to join us.
Really appreciate the invitation. I enjoyed talking with you about what's happening here in California.
Well, thanks again to Gabe Pettick. That was such a good conversation, full of lots of good information and lots of very, very large numbers, but still somehow digestible. He said a lot of things that I think folks in other states can take away from this, certainly in places that are dealing with their own deficits now. Maryland is one of them, and it's something I've been following closely. There was a story in the Baltimore Sun this week. It's actually a wire story from the Capital News Service. Shout out to Capital News Service, University of Maryland, where I'm an alum. It's called Blueprint or Budget Breaker. No one knows how to pay for Maryland's massive education reform. It's written by Kirsten Hacker and Christina Walker. And quick background on this blueprint. It's called, there was a law passed a few years back, massive education reform in Maryland. It was called the Blueprint for Maryland's Future. And it mandated massive, large increases in spending. It was going to call on local governments to pony up some cash as well, but it was largely a state-driven effort. And estimated to cost around $1.6 billion this year, around $4 billion by fiscal 2029. So billion-dollar increases every year. It is one of the reasons, though, that the state now is struggling to balance its budget. It's facing a deficit. And that what this story gets into is the fact that lawmakers, as the headline suggests, lawmakers don't know how they're going to pay for this massive education reform plan. And I'll pull out a couple of tidbits from it. So the state's going to start running. This is from the Department of Legislative Services fiscal briefing, which I think is very similar to California's LAO. The state is going to start running a structural deficit in fiscal year 2025, so that's next year, that will multiply nearly sixfold by fiscal year 2029. It'll hit just under $3 billion deficit. Not coincidentally, that very much coincides with the increasing costs that it's going to cost for the blueprint to go forward. The article says the General Assembly's plan for dealing with the cost crunch. There isn't one, at least not yet. Neither Governor Wes Moore in his State of the State nor any of the Democratic state legislators interviewed for the story offered any potential solutions. In fact, the story quotes State Senate President Bill Ferguson as saying several years from now, we're going to have a much more direct conversation about the long-term costs, but we're not there yet. And of course, Republicans, the small handful that are in the state legislature in Maryland, of course, say very much the opposite. The House Minority Leader Jason Buckle says we cannot pay these billions and billions of dollars in extra monies, not just state, but local as well. We can't pay for them unless you're going to talk about new taxes and significant taxes, which is an interesting, very interesting to hear from a Maryland Republican. Typically, they don't want to talk about new taxes. So, I mean, that to me just says how big of a deal this is. But I think what struck me about this story was it reminded me when Gabe was talking about the process of trying to go ahead with the budget without quite knowing in California, without quite knowing what their deficit was or what their income was going to be, essentially. And it's and California, Maryland, they're not the only states that do these things, that make educated guesses and move forward, and then they're wrong. And in this case, though, Maryland, you know, made that, shall I say, one of the public finances' seven deadly sins of of going ahead and saying you're going to pay for something and then, but not actually allocating the funds yet. And so not figuring out the way that you're going to pay for it. And, you know, and clearly there's some differing opinions in the state legislature about when this is going to be a problem and when those tough decisions are going to be made. But to me, again, what I took from what Gabe was talking about is better sooner now rather than later, because when you do put them off, as when the numbers do crystallize, as they did in California, now it's even harder to make those decisions. So there are a lot of parallels to me. And I think in drawing from Maryland, I think other listeners from other states as well can probably relate to some of those larger themes. Justin, what were some of the takeaways you had from the story?
Yeah, I like the parallels between this story and a lot of what we discussed with Gabe. States with lots of parallels, the both blue states with little geographically red pockets, both states that depend quite a bit on the income tax and capital gains tax. So similar sorts of fiscal situations in both states. Gabe also talked about economic mobility. And I think this is one of those really interesting touch points between the state budget and economic mobility. What does the public education system look like going all the way down to pre-K, you know, all the way through the system? And it's been interesting to watch. I think you see some echoes of this in the story, and again, some echoes in it in some of the discussion that we had with Gabe, that it used to be that state spending on public education was seen as, in some sense, a compliance function. Most state constitutions require providing for an adequate basic level of public education for all children who live in the state. There had been plenty of lawsuits over the years forcing that issue in many, many different states. Kansas in particular was one that had, you know, protracted litigation and court judgments and state oversight. I mean, all kinds of things in many, many other states that were designed to get at that question of what is an adequate public education and how much money do you have to spend to be able to say that you're meeting that obligation. But again, it was seen as kind of a requirement by the Constitution or the courts or whomever it might be. That's still very much the case a lot of places. But I think now you have a lot more state fiscal folks looking at these same issues saying, it shouldn't be a compliance issue. It really is fundamentally a question of economic mobility, which is fundamentally about the economic health of the state, which is what's going to drive future state budgets. And you see that in both of our conversation with Gaben and in the story that you have, in this case, legislators trying to get out ahead of this, right? Really trying to be proactive and think about where those investments need to be made. The hard part of that, of course, as you said, is you have to really think concretely about how to pay for it now, so that it doesn't come back and create those massive budget deficits in the not too distant future, which lead to all sorts of cuts, which can really undermine the very progress that you're starting to, that you are really intent on making when you make these investments. So it's a delicate balancing act. It's really interesting to see this kind of bold leadership in a state like Maryland. See if they can figure out how to pay for it. If they can, then they'll be a couple steps ahead of a lot of their peers. Thanks again to our Season 2 sponsors, Build America Mutual, MuniPro, Odyssey Advisors, and the Government Finance Officers Association. The Public Money Pod is a production of the Center for Municipal Finance at the University of Chicago's Harris School of Public Policy, where we are proudly produced by Hannah Burnick. You can learn more about the center and its work at munifinance.uchicago.edu. That's munifinance.uchicago.edu. You can learn more about Liz Farmer's work at her Substack, Long Story Short. That's Long Story Short. Thanks again for listening. We'll catch you next time on the Public Money Pod.